Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
I dreamt Uncle Sam was talking to the thunder of marching feet. And here's what he seemed to be saying to the soldier and the man on the street. Why are we working and fighting like we never did before? Oh, we wanna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. Why will we follow old glory where the flames and cannon roar? Oh, we wanna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. We're in line, we're all in line, and we're gonna keep our eye on the ball. You can bet we're in the threat to life and liberty once and for all. When we've destroyed those destroyers, there'll be peace forevermore. Oh, we're gonna make sure, we're gonna make sure there'll never be another war. Listen, Americans, you've got the right to say the things you want to say, and you're entitled to it. You've got the right to pray the way you want to pray, and you're entitled to it. You've got the right to live beneath a peaceful sky above. You've got the right to work and play and sing and laugh and love, and you're entitled to it. But today, there are those who would take those rights away. Today, the world is threatened by human beasts of prey. Today, we've got to unite and fight to defend each precious right from the forces of destruction. Then all the downtrodden people will be free from fear once more, and we'll bury the sword with the help of the Lord. There'll never be another war.
Get in your shelter, bomb, bomb. Don't helter-skelter, get yourself right underground. When those Nazis fly around, bomb, bomb. Get in the habit, bomb, bomb. Just like a rabbit, get yourself right underground. When those Nazis fly around, our AA gunners know their onions, they'll protect the town. Our airmen make the Jerry's frown. Tat-tat-tat-tat, there's another one down. Bomb, bomb, pants may be pinned up, bomb, bomb, don't get the wind up, get yourself right underground. When those Nazis fly around, when the sirens wail, don't you all get worried, just let calm prevail, don't get hot and flurried, just collect your family and quickly lead the way. Simply shout out, Bob's your uncle, and to them just say, bomb, bomb, get in your shelter, bomb, bomb, don't helter-skelter, get yourself right underground. When those Nazis fly around, bomb, bomb, get in the habit, bomb, bomb, just like a rabbit, get yourself right underground. When those Nazis fly around, our AA gunners know their onions, they'll protect the town. Our airmen make the Jerry's frown. Tat, 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 there's another one down. up, bum, bum. Don't get the wind up, get yourself right underground when those Nazis fly around. Another one down, bomb, bomb. Hands baby picked up, bomb, bomb. Don't get the wind up, get yourself right on the ground when those Nazis fly around. Get yourself right on the ground when the dirty devils all around.
Now it's time to take a look back at the events that shaped this country and the world with This Week in History on KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. In 70 AD, the Temple of Jerusalem burns after a 9-month Roman siege. In the year 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius erupts, destroying Pompeii, Herculaneum, and other smaller settlements. In 410, German barbarians sack Rome. In 1305, Scottish patriot William Wallace is hanged, drawn, beheaded, and quartered in London. In 1429, Joan of Arc makes a triumphant entry into Paris. In 1765, in protest over the Stamp Act, American colonists sack and burn the home of Massachusetts Governor Thomas Hutchison. In 1775, King George III of England refuses the American colonies' offer of peace and declares them in open rebellion. In 1780, King Louis XIV abolishes torture as a means to get suspects to confess. In 1847, Charlotte Bronte, using the pseudonym Carrère Bell, sends a manuscript of Jane Eyre to her publisher in London. In 1862, Union and Confederate troops skirmish at Waterloo Bridge, Virginia, during the Second Bull Run campaign. In 1862 as well, Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson seizes Manassas Junction, Virginia, and moves to encircle Union forces under General John Pope. In 1881, New York State's Pure Food Law goes into effect to prevent, quote, the adulteration of food or drugs. In 1882, Australia defeats England in cricket for the first time. The following day, an obituary appears in the Sporting Times addressed to the British team. In 1883, the Indonesian island of Krakatoa erupts in the largest explosion recorded in history. It was heard over 2,000 miles away in Madagascar. The resulting destruction sends volcanic ash up to 50 miles into the atmosphere and kills almost 36,000 people, both on the island itself and from the resulting 131-foot tidal waves that obliterate 163 villages on the shores of nearby Java and Sumatra. In 1891, Thomas Edison files a patent for the first motion picture camera. In 1894, Congress passes the first graduated income tax law, which is declared unconstitutional the next year. In 1900, Booker T. Washington forms the National Negro Business League in Boston, Massachusetts. In 1910, Thomas Edison demonstrates the first talking pictures using a phonograph in his New Jersey laboratory. In 1912, Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes first appears in a magazine. In 1914, the Emperor of Japan declares war on Germany. In 1916, the National Park Service is established as part of the Department of the Interior. In 1916, Italy declares war on Germany. In 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution is finally ratified, giving women the right to vote. Then in 1970, a nationwide women's strike for equality was led by Betty Friedan on the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. The strike calls attention to unequal pay and other gender inequalities in America. In 1921, the United States, which never ratified the Versailles Treaty ending World War I, finally signs a peace treaty with Germany. In 1926, American film star Rudolph Valentino dies, causing worldwide hysteria and a number of suicides. In 1942, German forces begin an assault on the major Soviet industrial city of Stalingrad. In 1944, German SS engineers begin placing explosive charges around the Eiffel Tower in Paris. In 1948, Edith May Irby becomes the first African-American student to attend the University of Arkansas. In 1949, the USSR explodes its first atomic bomb called First Lightning. The U.S. exploded its first nuclear bomb 4 years prior on July 16, 1945. The U.S. plutonium implosion device was tested at a site located 210 miles south of Los Alamos, New Mexico. In 1950, the International Olympic Committee votes to allow West Germany and Japan to compete in the 1952 Games. In 1950 as well, up to 77,000 members of the U.S. Army Organized Reserve Corps are called involuntarily to active duty to fight the Korean War. Also in 1950, President Harry Truman orders the U.S. Army to seize control of the nation's railroads to avert a strike. In 1954, Congress outlaws the Communist Party in the United States. In 1957, Ford Motor Company reveals the Edsel, its latest luxury car. In 1960, a U.S. U-2 spy plane spots SAMs, or surface-to-air missiles. They discovered the launch pads in Cuba. This would be the beginning of what is now called the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1963, one of the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, takes place and reaches its climax at the base of the Lincoln Memorial when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivers his I Have a Dream speech. In 1966, the Beatles give their last public concert in Candlestick Park, San Francisco. In 1968, a clash between police and anti-war demonstrators happens during the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. Also in 1968, Democrats nominate Hubert H. Humphrey for president at their Chicago convention. In 1977, Lou Brock of the St. Louis Cardinals breaks Ty Cobb's 49-year-old career record of 893 stolen bases. In 1979, Lord Mountbatten is killed by an Irish terrorist bomb in his sailboat in Sligo, Ireland. In 1981, John Hinckley Jr. pleads innocent to attempting to assassinate President Ronald Reagan. Also in 1981, Mark David Chapman was sentenced to 20 years to life for murdering former Beatles band member John Lennon. In 1982, the first gay games are held in San Francisco. In 1984, President Ronald Reagan announces the NASA Teacher in Space project, intended to inspire students and honor teachers, plus spur interest in the fields of science, mathematics, and space exploration. In 1966, Lunar Orbiter 1 takes the first photograph of Earth from the moon. In 1990, East and West Germany announced they will unite on October the 3rd, 1990. In 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev resigns as head of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Ukraine then declares its independence from the USSR. Also in 91, the Airbus A340 makes its first flight. In 1992, Hurricane Andrew makes landfall in Florida. The Category 5 storm, which had already caused extensive damage in the Bahamas, cost $26.5 billion in U.S. damages, caused 65 deaths, and felled 70,000 acres of trees in the Everglades. In 1996, Osama bin Laden issues a message entitled, quote, "A Declaration of War Against the Americans Occupying the Land of the Two Holy Places," end quote. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina reaches Category 5 strength, and the Louisiana Superdome is opened as a refuge of last resort in New Orleans. Rains from Hurricane Katrina caused levee breaches, one in particular at the Industrial Canal in New Orleans, causing severe flooding. In 2006, Pluto is downgraded to a dwarf planet when the International Astronomical Union redefines what a planet is. In 2008, Democrats nominate Barack Obama for president, the first African American nominated by a major political party for the office of the President of the United States. In 2011, a 5.8 magnitude earthquake centered at Mineral, Virginia, damages the Washington Monument, forcing the landmark to close for repairs. And in 2012, the U.S. Republican Convention nominates Mitt Romney as the party's presidential candidate. Remember to tune in next week for another look back at the events that shaped this country and the world with This Week in History on KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.
Gentlemen, I give you a toast to ladies and gentlemen. May this fair land we love so well in dignity and freedom dwell. Though worlds may change and go awry, while there is still one voice to cry. Country lane, wherever there's a cottage small beside a field of grain, there'll always be an England where there's a reach. Wherever there's a turning wheel, a million marching feet. Red, white, and blue, what does it mean to you? Surely you're proud, shout it out loud, Britain's away. The Empire too, we can depend on you. Freedom remains, these are the chains, nothing can break. There'll always be an England, and England shall be free. If England means as much to you as England means to me. Does it mean to you? Surely you're proud, shout it out loud, Britain's away. The Empire too, we can depend on you. Freedom remains, these are the chains, nothing can break. There'll always be an England, and England shall be free. If England means as much to you as England means to me.
Thank you for tuning in to 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. It was on this week back in 1984 that President Ronald Reagan announced the NASA Teacher in Space project, intended to inspire students, honor teachers, and spur interest in the fields of science, mathematics, and space exploration. Here is Ronald Reagan making the announcement.
Today I'm directed to begin a search in all of our elementary and secondary schools and to choose as the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program one of America's finest, a teacher.
2 years after this announcement, the Space Shuttle Challenger lifted off from Cape Canaveral and then proceeded to explode in midair, killing all on board. The Space Shuttle Challenger disaster was a fatal incident in the United States' space program. It occurred on January 28, 1986, when the Space Shuttle Challenger broke apart only 73 seconds into its flight, killing all seven crew members aboard. Listen in as Ronald Reagan speaks about the disaster.
I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union, but the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss. 19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Michalak. We mourn their loss as a nation together. To the families of the seven, we cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, "Give me a challenge, and I'll meet it with joy." They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us. We've grown used to wonders in this century. It's hard to dazzle us. But for 25 years, the United States space program has been doing just that. We've grown used to the idea of space, and perhaps we forget that we've only just begun. We're still pioneers. They, the members of the Challenger crew, were pioneers. And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue. I want to add that I wish I could talk to every man and woman who works for NASA or who worked on this mission and tell them, your dedication and professionalism have moved and impressed us for decades, and we know of your anguish. We share it. There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
That was Ronald Reagan speaking about the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger back in 1986. The spacecraft disintegrated over the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Cape Canaveral, Florida at 11:39 a.m. January 28, 1986. Media coverage of the accident was extensive. Children in schools were giddy with the chance to view the Space Shuttle launch. And the launch was widely viewed on television, mostly because of the presence of the high school teacher, Krista McAuliffe, who would have been the first teacher in space. You're listening to 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices. A Glance Back, I'm Rachel Steele reporting.
Drum boogie, drum boogie, the drum boogie woogie.
listening to 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. It was on this week back in 1963 that one of the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States occurred. It was called, quote, "The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom," end quote. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, also known simply as the March on Washington or the Great March on Washington, was held in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, August 28, 1963. The purpose of the march was to advocate for the civil and economic rights of African Americans. Listen in as the media at the time covers the march.
August 28, 1963. A quarter million Americans, black and white, young and old, descend on the nation's capital in a show of solidarity. It was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, but it would be remembered as a turning point in the fight for civil rights. Among the speakers, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who electrified the crowd with his stirring "I Have a Dream" speech.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
A few months earlier, racial tensions in the Deep South had erupted. News reports carried brutal images of fire hoses blasting at the backs of school children. President Kennedy had finally seen enough. In June of 1963, he presented sweeping civil rights legislation to Congress. Dr. King and others hoped a massive yet peaceful demonstration in Washington would spur passage of the bill. The city braced for violence, but their fears proved unfounded. The day of the march, more than 200,000 people gathered for a rally at the Washington Monument. It was the largest demonstration in the country's history. Arm in arm, they walked from the Washington Monument to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. There, performers as diverse as Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, and Mahalia Jackson lent their voices to the cause. Martin Luther King Jr. was the last to take the stage. He began with a reference to Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves a century earlier.
But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free.
Partway through, King put aside his prepared text and shared with the protesters his dream of equal rights for all.
Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
The march is credited with helping to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It preceded the Selma voting rights movement, when national media coverage contributed to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The march was organized by A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, who built an alliance of civil rights, labor, and religious organizations that came together under the banner of Jobs and Freedom. Estimates of the number of participants varied from 200,000 to 300,000, but the most widely cited estimate is 250,000 people. The march was one of the largest political rallies for human rights in United States history. At the march, the final speaker, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., stood in front of the Lincoln Memorial and delivered his historic "I Have a Dream" speech, in which he called for an end to racism. The march was deemed a huge success, and it produced one of the most famous speeches in American history. Listen now to a portion of Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech from Wednesday, August 28, 1963.
Pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Yes. This nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yes. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My Country, Tears of Thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California, not only that, let freedom ring. From Stone Mountain of Georgia, let freedom ring. From Lookout Mountain of Tennessee, let freedom ring. From every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
That was the I Have a Dream speech given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, August 28, 1963. You're listening to KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP. You're listening to 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices.
Taking a glance back at history with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Chapman was was sentenced to 20 years to life for murdering former Beatles band member John Lennon. It was on the evening of December the 8th, 1980, that English musician John Lennon, formerly of the Beatles, was shot and fatally wounded in the archway of the Dakota, his residence in New York City, by Mark David Chapman. His killer, Mark David Chapman, was an American Beatles fan from Hawaii. Chapman said he was angered by Lennon's lifestyle and public statements, especially his much-publicized remarks about the Beatles being, quote, more popular than Jesus, end quote. Chapman also objected to the lyrics in his later songs, God and Imagine. Chapman, who also said he was inspired by the fictional character of Holden Caulfield from J.D. Salinger's novel, The Catcher in the Rye. Let's head back to 1992 and listen to ABC's Barbara Walters as she interviews Chapman about his crime.
In 1992, 12 years after the murder, I sat down with Chapman at Attica Prison for his first television interview. His story of why he did it is as chilling today as it was then. Tonight, in the first of a new 2020 feature called Forward and Back, we take you on a journey back to December 1980 and inside the mind of a killer.
Who got shot? John Lennon.
John Lennon. He was a white man. And he was arguing with the doorman. And then all of a sudden he said 5-6 shots and that was it.
The cops pulled John Lennon out and put him into the back of a police car.
He was shot by an unknown, at this time, white male. He was in custody at this time.
Bring me back to December 8th, 1980.
It was a very long day. So I'm sitting there. It's dark. And this limo pulls up. And John got out. And he came up the pathway. And he looked at me. I heard this voice. Not an audible voice, but an inaudible voice saying over and over, do it, do it, do it, do it. I guess that was me inside. And I pulled the .38 revolver out of my pocket. I went into what's called a combat stance, and I fired at his back 5 steady shots.
Why did you kill John Lennon?
I thought by killing him, I would acquire his fame.
Chapman planned the killing over several months and waited for Lennon at the Dakota on the morning of December the 8th. During the evening, he met Lennon, who signed Chapman's copy of the album Double Fantasy, and subsequently left for a recording session at the record plant. Later that night, Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono returned to the Dakota. As they approached the entrance of the building, Chapman fired 5 hollow-point bullets from a .38 special revolver, 4 of which hit Lennon in the back. Chapman remained at the scene, reading The Catcher in the Rye, until he was arrested. Lennon was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital in a police car, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Listen in now as Ted Koppel and his team at ABC report the death of John Lennon on December the 8th, 1980.
He was shot late this evening in front of his apartment in New York City. Apparently, he was killed almost immediately. The man who shot John Lennon walked up to the musician as he was leaving his limousine. According to eyewitnesses, he said, "Mr. Lennon," and then fired at him point blank at least 5 times. Standing by now in New York with more details is ABC's Lynn Scherr.
John Lennon was murdered on his way home, just outside the celebrated Manhattan apartment house, the Dakota, where he lived with his wife, Yoko Ono, and a 5-year-old son. Apparently, he stepped out of the limousine and headed through the gates towards the vestibule when a man emerged and fired 7 times. According to police sources, the man had been seen at the apartment house earlier, and later in the evening when Lennon arrived, the man appeared to be rational. He called out Lennon's name, then crouched police style and fired.
The 4 cops pulled John Lennon out and put him into the back of a police car, and he was bleeding from his mouth, and it was a terrible sight.
John Lennon's body was immediately rushed in a police car here to Roosevelt Hospital, just 13 blocks away from his apartment in Upper Manhattan. He was dead on arrival. They tried resuscitation and they tried transfusions, but nothing worked.
How many times?
He had multiple gunshot wounds in his chest, in his left arm, and in his back.
How many shots have we talked about?
There were seven wounds in his body.
Seven bullets?
I don't know exactly how many bullets there were. There were seven wounds.
How extensive was the damage, Doctor?
There was a significant injury of the major vessels inside the chest, which caused a massive amount of blood loss, which probably resulted in his death.
Did he lose consciousness right away?
Dr. Lynn also said that as far as he could tell, Lennon died with the first shot. But that didn't stop a number of Lennon's fans from gathering at the hospital and at his apartment house to pray and to remember. Lynn Scher, ABC News, New York.
John Lennon was shot at a well-known New York apartment building, the Dakota House on West 72nd Street. And ABC's Rita Sands is standing by live at the Dakota now. Rita, what have you been able to learn since the shooting? Rita Sands, can you hear me?
No, you're on.
Rita?
Ted, what we know about the suspect at this time is, first of all, his identity, 25-year-old Mark David Chapman. He comes from Hawaii. Police tell me he's been in the New York area about a week and began to hang around the Dakota apartment over the weekend asking about John Lennon. He apparently ran into him for the first time this evening about 5 o'clock, asking Lennon for his autograph. Lennon gave it to him on the jacket cover of a record. Lennon went off to a recording session, and we are told that Chapman remained at the hotel until Mr. Lennon returned about 11 o'clock this evening. Police officials describe what happened this way. They say that Chapman came up from behind, yelled out Mr. Lennon's name, and emptied a .38 revolver. There were at least 5 shots spent. There were 7 gunshot wounds, considering both entrance and exit wounds. The worst damage came from the chest wounds. Lennon shouted that, "I know I've been shot." He stumbled up several steps into the Dakota and collapsed inside in an office area and was taken immediately to Roosevelt Hospital, where we are told he was dead on arrival. There is very little known about 25-year-old Chapman, only that he's been staying at a local Y for several days and then at another hotel in the last day or two. He has been taken to the 20th Police Precinct, fingerprinted. They're checking for prior arrest records. Also, for any motive, they don't have any yet. They've charged him officially with murder, but the reason for this attack, unknown. Ted?
Thank you, Rita Sands.
A worldwide outpouring of grief ensued on an unprecedented scale. Lennon was cremated at the Ferncliff Cemetery in Hartsdale, New York. In lieu of a funeral, Yoko Ono requested 10 minutes of silence around the world. Chapman pled guilty to murdering Lennon and was given a sentence of 20 years to life imprisonment at an upstate New York prison. He has been denied parole 11 times since he first became eligible in 2000. Now let's listen in as we play John Lennon's hit solo song, Imagine, on 94.7 KPIP.
Sky.